this episode of Newton Talks, I'm speaking to prolific novelist and poet R.M. Francis, whose work frequently focuses on the Black Country and the wider West Midlands. He's here to talk to me about his new poetry collection, Palmer, out now with V Press. And before we start, let's hear one of his poems read by R.M. Francis himself.
St. Peter's Church, Wolverhampton. It seemed a shame to see scaffolding usurp the heavenly tower of St. Peter's, set against the grey every day in Wolfren's Burgh, where grandmother waits amongst nicotine fumes, loaded with bag for life, as the Billbrook bus sits delayed behind the clatter-clack blur of the city. He steps into the empty church, strolls the nave perimeter, seeks a clerestory light, lights two votive candles, inhales smoky prayer, turns to see a rubble of ruined sandstone chimera, scrapped against crocket and cornice, stacked by the great wooden threshold, the splintering of outside's light rain coursing through the stained glass. And he smiled at the morning star of the moment. He attends to tusks cracked in fractured jaws, just clutching to their own hateful grin, and in the tiny lift of time, a tall figure seen dimly.
Tell us about your latest work, Palmer, and what inspired it.
Yeah, so Palmer came out last week on the 19th of September with V Press, and it's a collection of poems about faith, about the divine, about parenthood, and the changes that parenthood bring about. And they're quite confessional, I suppose, personal poems that sort of wrestle with my relationship with God and the divine and the sort of narratives of Christian faith, I suppose. Those are the ideas that I'm wrestling with. A lot of the poems in there are sort of ekphrastic poems. For listeners that don't know what that is, it's when you write from art, when you write from an image or a sculpture or something like that. So what I've done is taken quite a lot of icons, quite often from early church, and the really beautiful kind of Eastern Orthodox carvings and icons, and tried to kind of eke out the symbolic and narrative moments in those to use as a kind of starting point for the poems as well. So some of them are kind of about my own experiences, some are about observations that I've had and thoughts that I've had, and then right at the centre of the collection is a sequence that's a kind of reworking of the end of the gospel, basically, the passion.
So you say about working from the sort of the icons that are springing off points, because one of the questions I had was that there seems to be a lot of references in this collection. So you've even got like the reference list at the end.
Yeah.
Is that part of that? You're not just coming from a Christian iconography or sacramental iconography, but also from other poems and other snatches of writing and things like that. Would you say that's part of the same process?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. You know, I mean, a big part of it was listening to other scholars and reading other scholars. I'm a big fan of Bishop Barron and his YouTube channel. I've sought a lot of wisdom from him, and also the kind of symbolic and kind of metaphysical conversations that you have with people like John Vervaeke and Jonathan Pageau. In fact, really, it was Jonathan Pageau that really kick-started it. A couple of Easters ago, he gave a talk about the different symbols that you see in the various icons across Holy Week. And I was so struck by it, I thought, right, that's a good way in. Let's see if I can write a poem for each of the really important moments of Holy Week. And that kind of moved out into looking at people like Sally Reid's work and some of the older Christian writers like Manly Hopkins and T.S. Eliot and Denise Levertov, who aren't just like Christian writers. They're writers that are properly kind of wrestling with the idea. I mean, one of Levertov's lines, I'm going to butcher this, but it's something like, my doubt is interrupted by my faith, and my faith is interrupted by my doubt. So it's coming at it with that sort of spirit in place. But yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a collage in some way in terms of the influences of bits that I've read, bits that I've listened to, and then art in the main, icons and paintings that I've just kind of stared at and studied.
Would you say you've got a theology, or are you just sort of working it out through the process of putting this collection together? And to what degree do you engage with theology and writers? I mean, you've hinted at it there that it's maybe has inspired certain ways of thinking. So I just wondered to what degree that was a factor when it came to composing the poems, and whether you think retrospectively, you're kind of working out a theology through the process of writing.
Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, the tagline for the collection, so V Press do this thing, it's part of their kind of branding that every publication they put out, they say title of the poem is very something and very something. And the tagline for Palmer is that Palmer is very wandering, as in to wander on your feet, and wondering, as in to wander in one's mind. And that kind of sums it up, really. And you'll see, well, readers hopefully that pick up the book will see that there are poems in there that feel like they're in the voice of somebody who's in the grasp of faith and embracing it, and other poems that are a little bit more cautious or less sure as well. So there's definitely the sense that I'm trying to work out how I feel in the poems as much as they are kind of songs of faith and prayer as well. I'm not a church-going Christian. And there's part of me that thinks, who the hell am I to say I believe? Because I'm just some tiny little human. But I do know that from my experience and other people's experiences that I've spoken to and read about, is that there's a kind of pragmatic quality about the teachings that allow you to start to unmask the wonder behind what seemingly everyday things. I don't know whether that makes sense, really, but that's kind of where I am. So, I mean, I suppose I take the scripture seriously and I take the theological seriously. And I'm deeply interested in it from a kind of emotional side of things and a practical side of things, but also on a spiritual side of things as well. But I like to do it on my own terms because I'm a poet and we're weird as well. Fundamentally, what it comes down to is that I am now, over the last sort of 5 or so years, much more open to the idea that God is real and heaven is real, and that the most sophisticated articulation of the terrestrial and the divine is in the New Testament.
I think one of the sub questions I had to that last question was that I noticed in not just in these poems, but and also throughout your writing anyway. You really seem to emphasize the earthy and the bodily and the sense, which has got a kind of I suppose a kind of Catholic kind of element to that.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
But you've also got the emphasis on the personal relationship, which is very much the which is maybe more a sort of a Protestant approach to it. And I think that sense of what you said there about not being church going, by that I presume you mean not to mass or serve or to the services, but
Yeah.
you visit churches when they're open, I would imagine.
That's exactly it, James, yeah. I really love being in a church. I don't really like being part of a service. So I visit St. Peter's Church in Wolverhampton on a regular basis, and I will sit and light a candle and say a few prayers and walk the perimeter and just sit and be calm and quiet for a while. And that's lovely and beautiful and really rewarding for me. But for some reason, I'm not called to come to the service, if you like. But it's interesting what you say about the bodily and and Catholicism, because that's definitely there. I'm leaning towards that for sure. But I also think there is something profound that happens physiologically to us in different moments of beauty, thrill, fear, dread, joy as well. So it's kind of connecting there. And I think I see these poems and my leaning a little bit more into Christian mysticism than any kind of definite school of Christianity, because in that the body and the mind are the body and the mind and soul, if you like, are symbiotic as
Yeah.
well. I mean, William Blake would have said similar things, that you can't take the I out, you can't take the physical, biological I away from the idea of the imagination. So that's the body is the way in as much as it is the end, the thing that rots.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder that relates to a couple of questions I've got. Yeah, maybe we'll deal with this one. They're sort of related, really. But it's this that I'm not, and this is to do with Palmer. Is this idea of the bringing together the kind of sacramental elements of church with the everyday? And I'm thinking of lines like from feet washing, on my hands the stench of sterilized wipes and a thorny weaving of death shroud and conjugal sheet. And the conjugal sheet, you'll come back to that imagery as well, I think, in a later poem, Empty Tomb. So I was interested in, is that relating to what you were just saying, this idea of the words you're using, the imagery you're using, bringing together the very kind of quotidian, the very sort of the things we touch and deal with every day, but looking beyond that into this idea of the kind of the divine in these elements. Is that
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. That, I mean, I'm a really huge admirer, and he was always been a really important inspiration in my work, of the poet David Constantine, who wrote a really great essay called The Common and the Peculiar, where he argues that great poetry tries to bring together the mundane and the wondrous, or the everyday and the peculiar, both through its language and its form, but also in its subject matter. So I've been ploughing that field for a long time, poetically anyway. But there's something that rings true to me there about the religious experience in the kind of day to day as well. So yeah, I'm suggesting that there is a beautiful religious moment to be had in wiping your child's mouth and witnessing a pregnant woman on a train station, and memories of childhood tea times and things like this.
So I wonder if we go in if I'm just going deeper into that, or whether I'm even asking the same question. But it's a little bit about your idea of the these sort of liminal spaces that seem to crop up repeatedly in your writing. And I'm thinking not just again in Palmer, in the poems of Palmer, but also in your novels as well and your short stories, where you often seem to be writing about in between spaces and times. I mean, you just mentioned there about, the pregnant woman on the train station, right? A train station in between space. And you are, I'm trying to think of some other examples. Well, Bella is about in between spaces, or this space that doesn't really belong to anyone, or this, certainly the geography of it. And the Renner, I guess, is all about this estate that's between one thing and another thing, and it's neither urban and it's nor is it a rural. It's kind of holds both, and a lot of your writing seems to be about the sort of the horror, or the disgusting, or the erotic, or the decaying, or the tenderness in these sort of spaces, down side streets, alleyways. There's other kind of examples I've got here where you're often talking about, you mentioned things spanning centuries in the poem Antony, and I'm thinking about things crossing generations. In Saint Clement, you mentioned in Peter's Footprints and Almost Parents. I like that idea as well. You're not quite there. You're not one thing or the other. That I love that kind of that phrase. And between moss and algae and a discarded mitten, there's sort of all of these things are about in between and things that are discarded.
Yeah, I mean, it's a preoccupation, definitely. Not just what of mine, but I would say of English literature across quite a broad scope as well, you know. I mean, thresholds and marginal positions and liminal locations, be those figurative or literal, are space times where transformation takes place of some sort. And that's what writers are kind of seeking out. They're seeking out those moments of change, of revolution, of epiphany, and these sorts of things. So that's in part why I'm drawn to it, because it's a sort of crucial crux of narrative. But I also just find it exciting as well, because it's a the threshold, the doorway. These are places, at least for a small moment, you can be, or one can be, ruleless. And sometimes that plays out in subversion and transgressions and filth, like you said, and dread, but also it can play out in absolute joy and wonderment and true beauty as well. So I am definitely drawn to those, and it is a preoccupation in my work. I mean, Thin Places is another poem as well, isn't it, that I'm talking about? So there's in Palmer. You know, these are also locations where quite often you're, it's difficult to talk about it logically, because it's a metaphysical thing. It's not a figurative thing as such, and it's not a literal thing as such. It's somewhere between those. And so not only is the liminal and the in-between and the threshold something where you transform, and something that's open for ruleless, unruly, carnivalesque type activities, it's also the place where ghosts might come and go. It's also the place where spirits might come and go. And it's also, by extension, the place that angels and other spiritual beings might come and go as well.
I wonder whether there's a kind of a theological a element to that. We access the divine in always in the present moment, right? Rather than something else. And about looking into those and examining those minor moments, those small moments, those fleeting moments, and the marginal and the in those spaces that seem to be in between, it hints at a kind of a sense of the divine in the present and in the now.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. You don't, one doesn't realize an experience of the divine as an afterthought. So there's definitely something there, isn't there? You don't have a magical or wondrous or phenomenal experience and then a few days later go, I wonder if that was God. It either happens to you or it doesn't. And so paying attention to those moments that you would normally pass by, or you'd be on autopilot or whatever, are going to be moments where you can seek great meaning and curiosity as well.
Yeah, and I think that I mean, this is just my observation on your work, the kind of the emphasis on almost that extreme detail. I was going to say mundane. I didn't mean that so much as the everyday that we would normally skip over, and brings me on to my next question. And again, this is a sort of rambling question, so sort of kind of take out what you can from this and ask me to repeat it if it doesn't make any sense. But you have a lot of very specific detail across all your work that you often include without qualifiers or context. And I'm thinking things like street names, landmarks, that you don't really explain to the reader what this is, where it is, why it's there, what it might be. And sometimes that might be very obvious stuff, like it's Wilko's or it's a particular shop that people will recognize. So are you expecting readers to make connections between your specific spaces that you're explaining or that you're referencing and their own specific places, shops and streets? Or are you sort of asking people to kind of enter into the world and figure out what shop, what street, what estate you're referring to? And I wonder whether that's both whether it seems it makes your writing both alienating to the reader, but also familiar at the same time, and whether that just again feeds in a larger sense to the kind of things that we've been talking about, the alienating and the familiar, the kind of the I suppose you could use the word uncanny and the familiar as well. I suppose that might come into it, that sort of thinking. Certainly in your short story collection, the how do you pronounce that? Amelis? How do you pronounce it?
Amelez,
Amelez,
I'd say,
yeah.
but I could be wrong.
Amelez, Currents of Unmindfulness, which I think deals with a lot of that about the kind of alienating detail, but also out of the familiar.
Above almost all things from my writing practice, I consider myself a landscape writer, first of all. I'm intrigued by place and the spirit of place and the place identity of particular locations. A lot of my work is based and set and inspired by the Black Country, but I've gone further afield in later works as well. But I'm just very interested in trying to sniff out what makes particular places distinct and intriguing, and that they have their own, even if it's just as subtle as a slightly different mood or atmosphere, why that is and what it is. So that's part of the reason that I like to use very, very specific detail. But another part of that is back to your point about familiarity and anchoring as well. Because even though it might be a poem or a short story or a novel that's really, really local, it's only really when you get very, very local and specific that you can allow more universal elements to come out. If you just speak in the general or the broad, it doesn't have any concrete grounds for the reader to hang on. And so it becomes sort of abstract and less accessible in some ways. I suppose it's in some ways a kind of my aim, and it might sound polar in this, is to introduce people to locations that they might not have seen before and might have overlooked themselves. But also that in getting down into the street names and the litter on the streets and a particular road or church or working men's club or whatever, people can also see that in their own neighborhoods. And it might be a completely different neighborhood, but there's still the sense of familiarity about it. On one hand, it's directing people to places that I find interesting and hope they will too, but also that I'm using that very, very specific naming and detailing as a way to anchor them to something bigger as well.
That's really useful. I suppose when I was listening to that, I figured out another way of thinking about it was that your work is on the one hand extremely specific, but it doesn't have a journalistic element to it where you explain to us how long this pub's been there and what usually happens at the pub and what sort of pub it is. It's just the whatever pub that it is that you're referring to, and this happens there. So I suppose that I feels unique about your work, and also I think feeds into that bigger question that we the bigger questions about your style and how that relates to the content as well. But back to your work, and across your stories, both the novels, the short stories, and maybe to a lesser extent the poems, which tend to be a little bit more place oriented, we're introduced to a lot of characters. We get a lot of characters in your work, but because you write in this kind of fragmentary way, or we show them mainly speaking or doing things, or perhaps we get other characters describing who this other character is and what they've done and what they've been caught for or whatever it is. There's a slight kind of opaqueness to these characters as well. So I'll just as a kind of question, how well do you know the characters that you're writing? Do you work them out as you're writing? Are they based on any actual people? How do you go about constructing these characters?
I mean, when I'm working in prose in particular, and especially the longer pieces like Bella and the Renner, it starts off with you just playing around. You throw in words at a piece of paper and you've got some vague ideas of mood or atmosphere or setting. And as you start playing, themes emerge and patterns of speech emerge and different word combinations emerge and you start to develop a voice. And then from that voice, you can start to hear and see and think through the characterization. And that tends to be the way I work my way into my main character or main characters of a piece. The more opaque and satellite figures, if you like, of the stories tend to be observations of people that I know or of bits of conversation that I've overheard and things like that, because there doesn't need to be. I don't want the reader to pay attention to them in the same way that I need them to pay attention to Michelle and Tim in my first novel, or the unnamed character in The Renner. They need to know and see and sense everything that goes through their minds and their senses. Whereas the other characters are there as a chorus line, if you like, or as slightly different counter melodies as well. So there's a structural and formal need for that, to colour the text in those ways.
Yeah, and I think that's quite interesting because they provide us, as you say, a chorus line. They provide a sort of a tone. Those more peripheral characters of the kind of world in which that we are inhabiting.
Well, that's it, yeah. And then, the characters in Bella and the characters in The Renner and to some extent some of the stories in Amelie's, these are scenes where you walk into the boozer and there might be the guy in the corner that you sort of vaguely recognise but you don't really know, and there's another guy that you chatted to last week but somehow doesn't want to know you this week. And then there's people that you definitely sit down with and drink with. And that's sort of the experience of kind of working class black country neighborhoods as well. So there's that element of placemaking about it too, I think.
Maybe this is a really kind of lame question, really, but it's just of an interest. Like, would you say that? I mean, they're sort of set around the same sort of area, geographical location, particularly Bella and the Renner. Do you see them as being part of the same sort of universe? Do you see them as continuous, and would you see there is even a crossover then between some of the stories that are happening in Amelie's and these other? The other novels you've done. And I wonder whether even your own writing, the more personal poems,
in
his latest collection. Would you see that as part of the same fictional world?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I don't know whether I see it as part of the same story world or fictional world, but they definitely share a lot of space in the imaginal and in the literal settings as well. I mean, and funnily enough, I mean, I wrote Bella. Bella was part of my PhD, so I wrote that for my PhD. And because I got lucky and got a scholarship to do my PhD, it meant I could quit the daytime job and just dedicate myself to writing. So I had kind of 3.5 years where all I did with my life was read and write. And it was beautiful. But it also meant that I got a hell of a lot done. So as well as completing Bella, I started working on the Renner around the same time. I started working on Subsidence around the same time as well. And I quite often work like that. I'll have maybe two or three projects on the go at the same time that vaguely, thematically, or in terms of character or setting or mood, link with each other. And that helps me as a writer in terms of the boring kind of practical stuff, because it means that if I wake up one morning and I'm not feeling the novel, I can turn to a short story or I can have a go at writing some poems. And in writing the poems, I'm working out the problems of the novel. In writing the novel, I'm working out the problems of the short story, and that tends to help me. And so it's natural that there would be some kind of cross-pollination happening there. I mean, it's also that, I mean, there are distinctions. I mean, Bella is, I would say, quite much more feminine, if you like, softer type of a narrative, even though it's quite a brutal story and it's a ghost story. Renner is much more violent, it's much more male focused, and Subsidence, I suppose, is more obviously political, dealing with who we are and why we're here, kind of, and how we're looked at in the Black Country as well. And yeah, I mean, I think one project does seem to kind of bleed out into other projects, because as strange as it feels, the last book that I bought out just before Amylez was The Chain Coral Chorus, which is a strange mix of poems, field notes, and essays from the time that I was poet in residence for the Black Country Geological Society. And those are poems, they're nature poems in lots of ways, and they're poems that use the earth sciences, both in its kind of language and in its method, to eke down into the sense of place. But when I was doing those very earthy, very scientific type writing, something of the spiritual came up. There's something about finding your location. I mean, that's Jacob's story, isn't it? He goes out, he places the rock down, and he has this moment of epiphany. So there was something that happened there that led me into what came next as well. And weirdly enough, I think Palmer, in some ways, is the kind of, it's not an antithesis as such, but it is a bit of a yin and yang to the short story collection, Amylez. Because Amylez is what happens to people in the absence of meaning and joy and connectivity, and Palmer is the nice side of that. Well, not necessarily the nice side, but the side that has more purpose to it.
I like what you said there about the working out the problems of writing. It seems to be that's when I'm making the films anyway. It seems to be entirely just working out, constantly working out problems that I've set for myself,
Yeah.
and not always finding a solution either, and just having to kind of make do often.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the creative thing, isn't it? I mean, I quite often you I mean you might have had this at screenings and things in the past, where someone will say, "Where do you get your ideas from?" And it's all, well, the idea is the easy bit. Any schmuck can come up with an idea. It's like you try and find the structure and the form and the logistics to put it together. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's always when people ask you, particularly students, is this a good idea? And one, I don't know. And two, maybe, yes, everything's a good idea. Everything's a good idea and a shit idea at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah,
So
probably.
until you do it, it means nothing. at this point.
Yeah.
So, let's hear another poem written and read by R.M. Francis.
Taking him down, ashen-skinned and dense, a cold, soft, unreal, drops and slaps against the men charged with removing his emptied body. Limbs quickly drop, pulling head groundward, a cheap plastic shopping bag overpacked with butcher's offcuts clapping on concrete. The sun is almost gone now, and Mary, on her knees, eyes bleached in sorrows, cannot look, cannot stop her unlooking. They try to be kind, they try to be delicate, they try to float a naked corpse down on genoia cloth, a cold, soft, unreal.
But another question about that sort of the kind of practicalities of it. And this, again, I keep qualifying these questions, and I wonder whether this is a really stupid one. But you've got some of your work is extremely short, right? So some of these poems are extremely short, just one or two lines. And I just wondered whether with the very, very short ones, same with your very short stories, some of them are sort of a page, page and a half. Do you get the sense of that's how short they should be? How do you ever think of whether you should come back to this and lengthen it? I know I've saw Philip Larkin talking about, or read Philip Larkin when he was talking about one poem might take years to write. He comes back and sees what he's written and then finishes it off. I wonder what your process is of actually writing and composing the poems for Palmer.
Yeah, it's a. In some ways, it's a mystery. And I never really know why something is good or good enough and why other things aren't. It's just a gut thing in some ways. I mean, the process I apply is the same with all my writing, really. I have a decent routine. I get up in the morning and that's my time to write. And I get up early to just at least get half an hour done a day. But I always approach that as an exercise. I approach it as an experiment, because that sort of takes the pressure off me. I don't have to think, God, I've got a poem that needs to be done, or I've got to finish that short story. I'm just writing for the hell of it. And more often than not, I'm literally just flinging words at a page. So I'll stand at the window and look out and think, right, yeah, today I'll write something about the sun, or I'll write something about the grass, or I'll write something about whatever is on my mind. And I mean, this was a trick that my MA tutors gave me, really, that you just destroy the blank page, just get words and phrases down. And then you can spend a bit of time thinking about, right, what are the connections between these words and phrases? What are the bits that sound interesting and cool, and why might that be? Where are the things that spark and clash? And then you can start forming things. So that's the first kind of part of the process. In that, you're finding things that call out to you, that need to be said or need to be explained. And you can, from there, you can start to get to grips with, all right, well, this is probably an essay, because it's more of an argument and a question. And this is more of a short story, because I'm following a character across a place. And this has got more in-betweens and I don't knows about it. So it's probably going to be a poem. And again, you get an instinctive vibe about what idea is going to be what type of form. But it's only really through serious and kind of regular disciplined play that you get that way. And it's not that it's completely footloose and fancy free. I mean, obviously Palmer is a collection that is thematic. They're not just random scribbles of poetry. They're in a particular order, they're addressing particular themes. So part of that is the play is also directed as well on a particular idea or a particular set of ideas. And it just slowly grows as you get up and do it every day.
I wonder whether it's a part of the sense of kind of marshalling chaos, and there's an idea of, you know, bringing back to this idea of the genesis of the creation of the world as well. This idea of pure energy, right? And it's nothing, and it's formless, and it's just this could be absolutely anything. And every time you kind of work on it, you're molding it and molding it and molding it and creating it, creating this energy into something. And I think that's the kind of process of creation. And I suppose it really helps to think of that as your creative process, whether it's writing scripts, making films, whatever it might be, constantly wrestling with this thing which could be as big as the universe. And every time you work on it, you're narrowing it, molding it down into something smaller, into what it eventually is. And I suppose that idea of marshalling the chaos and trying to control the chaos and to try and get a sense of that energy of chaos is what creativity is.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. There's some kind of unusual and urge that can't be kind of articulated, that you that the creative recognizes something that needs to be needs to be brought to ground, if you like, and to be grounded properly. And it's through messing and playing and messing that you start to find the right structure for it as well. I mean, I'm really into music as well, and like you hear musicians talk about this quite often. I mean, I can't remember his name now. Who's the guitarist from My Bloody Valentine? He apparently he would sit in the studio and spend sort of 6 hours trying to find the right sound for the guitar, and then he would do a take in like 3 minutes. So it would be as if he was channeling and channeling and trying to find the right frequencies and trying to find the right tone, and then it would be like, right. And there is a feel of that about the creative process as well, that you think and you play and think and you play, and then suddenly you go, oh. Which is why every now and then it feels like your poem's just kind of been ripped out of your head.
Yeah, sometimes it's easy, but maybe it's been like it's been gestating there for in ways that you couldn't ever have identified before.
And sometimes you agonize over things as well, you know.
Can I ask? So, leading on from that, so you're obviously steeped in academia as well. You part of, you know, your first novel comes out of your PhD. Presumably, this is a sort of practice as research PhD that you're doing. So, those kind of questions in terms of the creative process. Are they kind of things that you're working through in your when you're pr provide you have to provide a rationale for the work that you're doing? How do you marry the academic process and the creative process? To me, certainly from my experience, I see them as two separate processes. They're probably not, in fairness. I think what we've just talked about, I can see the links between them. But certainly, my film work is maybe instinctual in a way that the academic work is less so, and I find it difficult to marry those two things together.
I agree. I think I find I find the creative writing easier. That's for sure. And it does feel more instinctive. Probably because I've been doing it longer, I guess. And it's something that I need to do. I mean, I love the academic side of things, and I love the research and actually writing academically. I enjoy as well. But it is a different skill, and it's a different way of making meaning as well, isn't it? I mean, I suppose a lot of my academic work leans back out to literary criticism a little bit. So I'm assessing the ways that other writers, including myself, have done what we've done and the patterns in those. And I also lean out towards the theories that underpin my work a little bit more. Even if I'm so, and that's quite useful as well sometimes, because you know, if you're creating a poem or a short story, you don't really know. It's not like you go into it and you say, I'm going to do something with Freud's uncanny, or I'm going to do something with X, Y, or Z. It's only really after the event that you can kind of start thinking it through and you go, oh, yeah, I see the. I see that, so I can now extrapolate that theory and talk about why that, how and why that works in my work. So that's part of it as well. And you know, because so much of my work is about place and movement through place, there's quite a lot of material I can use to think through not just the creative process, but what it means around geography, mobility studies, environmental psychology, and things like that. And then, of course, there's an element that creatives in academia can actually talk through the efficacy of their process as well.
Yeah, I mean that's certainly useful in terms of the passing that on, and if you, especially if you're teaching like I do, I teach practice as well. So that's obviously that's I find that certainly invaluable for well more than anything, in helping students work out their own problems, right? Right. Let me ask you a question about this idea, particularly as we work in academia and the current environment. Shall we call it of the way? And I think there's a certain the way that certain circles think about this idea of, let's say, wokeism in higher education, which I think is overblown to a degree in some areas, particularly on a module level. I think from what I've seen. At the same time, it's an environment that is unforgiving for artistic expression, I would say. And if you have an artistic expression that is testing testing ideas in a way that you seem to go against the current received wisdom, it can lead to, you know, really difficult problems in terms of either censorship or closing down of at the worst extent of people's jobs and livelihoods. So how have you encountered that in your recent writing and your recent performances that you've done and your current job?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, I think some of it is overblown. Some of it is a kind of hangover from things that are happening in the States that aren't necessarily happening in the same at the same level or to the same intensity over here. But there are still pockets, and those pockets do seem to have quite a lot of weight as well. So it needs a keen eye on it. I mean, I've had people try and shut down readings of mine over the years. One quite notably, and I mean, my reaction to that. I mean, well, first of all, on accusations that are really spurious and actually close to being libelous, more than anything else, which I don't want to get into the details of, but I mean, I think my gut react, well, the way that I think this through, and this is just my take really, is that the alternative is worse if you shut up. I worry that there's lots of people, particularly young people, that are worried about what they can and can't say. And I try to have that kind of Oscar Wilde ethos in my mind that there's no such thing as a moral or immoral book. Books are either well written or badly written. And I think that's how we should process literature and the arts generally. I think, you know, the whole point in the arts is that they're there to, warts and all, offer mirrors and templates and new ways of seeing and new possibilities for looking and being in the world. And part of that will be unpalatable to some. But you can't say anything that's interesting or deep without running the risk of offending someone. We need to be quite robust as artists and say this is not an okay thing to do. For anything other, I mean, there's plenty of things that we could say about this, but for anything else, like, how do you know at some point that this isn't going to turn around on you? I mean, I think that's one of the things that I find so maddening about it is the apparent clarity of moral that some of these people have, that they're on the right side of history and they're definitely the right, the good and the virtuous. Well, time will tell, I would say. And you don't want to hand over those sorts of freedoms willy-nilly because you don't know who's going to be steering the ship in 3 years' time, 10 years' time, 15 years' time. I think it's very dodgy. And I would hate to see what's happening right now in the States, in the universities, happening over here as well. You know, I think the kind of liberal left have had quite a lot of sway in US universities for a long, long time. And that probably needed some kind of balancing out or dealing with in some way. But the answer seems to have been from the States to shut it all down, pull all the funding, and shut those heretics up. Well, that's exactly what we're trying to rally against. And I've got lots of friends and colleagues that are doing really interesting work in fields that I don't really have that much say or interest in, but that's their job to be interested and say things in that field. And we need them, however much we might disagree or be indifferent or disinterested in it. It's all adding to that kind of soup of culture that we've got. And I think it would be very, very dangerous for us to try and go down that line over here. I hope it doesn't get to that. It all seems just so bad spirited. That's the word for it, really, I think. It's anti-curiosity. It's the antithesis of truth seeking, and it quite often to me seems quite petty and closed-minded.
Yeah, I wonder whether there's a performative element about it as well. Certainly, if you know that people know that they're going to get an audience or they know that they're going to get a reaction, then it encourages people to play out these ideas as well. I wonder whether that's also an element. Like there's an element of theatre to it. If they can know that they can be online looking good, looking righteous, looking angry, there's clearly some form of dopamine hit that comes from that, which.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think you see that pendulum going both ways as well, don't you? You
Of
know,
course.
the reactions to the censorship are starting to become quite ugly as well, aren't they?
Absolutely. I think before it would have been a case of you needed to go to a particular place, or you're asked your opinions, or there's a particular place where there would be an argument would develop, or it would be whether it's a hustings or whether it's a demonstration. Whereas if you can just continue that into an online social media space as well, it sort of never switches off, which I think leads to the sort of the constant boiling of it. There's no point where the kettle's kind of switched off, really. It's constantly bubbling, because as soon as you finish in the let's say the sanctioned space where you might go to a protest or do or some kind of public debate, and if it's just carrying on as the second that you finish that in an online space, it's never switched off. Yeah, don't you, you? You're very articulate when you discuss that. I'm far less. It's one of the reasons why I asked you the question, because I figured you'd say what I was thinking in a far less rambling way than I would have been able to put it. I've got one more question for you. Just it's just it was skipping back actually to think about your kind of influence and you mentioned the music. I know you're a fan of kind of Iron Maiden and heavy metal. So can you just explain to me how that figures? How something like that might influence or inform your work, or whether it's just something that you do to switch off, or how do you marry that?
Well, I think it was rock music in particular that first got me interested in literature. You know, I hand my being led into the kind of literary world over to bands like Iron Maiden. And, you know, because I got really excited by the music and the theatre of it all as a young kid, and how kind of loud and kind of full throttle bands like Iron Maiden were. And then you start listening to the lyrics when you get a little bit older, and you start paying attention to the lyrical content as you get a little bit older. And Maiden were singing songs about Brave New World and Revelations and Rime of the Ancient Mariner and Blake and Crowley and all sorts of things. And I just followed the lead, really. I was like, okay, well, what is this Brave New World? Oh, it's a Huxley book. And so I read it. And who is this Rime of the Ancient Mariner? Oh, it's a Coleridge poem. And I read it. And so it was that kind of led me into to being interested in literature and whatnot. And then as I got older, I got really into the Smiths and really into the Manic Street Preachers. And obviously the Manics were just machine gun literary references into their work. So, you know, I hold those bands like quite highly responsible for the way I got into literature. I mean, I suppose these days I listen to it for the fun of it. And but I am quite nerdy about it as well. I'll sit and, you know, listen to the midsection of Power Slave over and over again to try and figure out what Adrian and Dave are doing with their guitars. Not that I'm a particularly good musician at all, but there's something very pleasing about just recognizing how melodies work against each other and how beats and rhythms and melodies work against each other. And that, I suppose, does help my writing, because I think about my writing in a kind of orchestral way, that it's not just words on a page, it's sounds and shapes on a page as well. And I love music just across the board as well, you know. I mean, like, metal is where one foot will always be, but the other foot is in jazz and pop and hip hop and all sorts of areas. I find it quite inspiring. I'm in awe of them as well, like particularly brilliant musicians. And I'm really keen on musicians that seem to write just like good pop songs, but then when you start listening to it, you're like, oh my God, how did you know that was going to work? You know, Paul McCartney, Elvis Costello, Ron Sexsmith. These are writers that just sound like they've just tripped a three chord song out, but there's so much happening in them. And I find that really inspiring and envious of it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That envy is I think is something that's really kind of humbling, and not necessarily in a bad way as an artist, but
No.
in a good way as an artist to
Yeah.
be continually humble. Yeah, you're right about the Manic Street Preachers. I mean, they're responsible for me being into so much Manic Street Preachers and Monty Python. Really, things you did when you were 16, you didn't understand any of this stuff, so you're forced to go to the library and to find
Yeah.
out what it is that they're kind of referencing, and you find that it's in your work. I mean, I was going through, people have asked me, where did you come up with ideas for this, or what's that line about? And I'm thinking, oh yeah, I got that from Steptoe and Son, didn't I? I didn't even know, but it just becomes part of my reference point. I wasn't even aware of that I put it in, but it becomes kind of part of your palette, really, even if you don't know it. Some of these, the things that you listened to when you were young and watched when you were young.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, the lady I work with, and she's a dear friend of mine, Kerry Hadley Price, brilliant, brilliant writer. She's forever telling our students, and we're forever having conversations about this. And she says, you can't be a writer unless you're nosy. And I really think that, and I think that's probably across the board of creativity as well, that unless you've got some kind of radical curiosity. And sometimes it's not just a curiosity about, like, how do fishermen do that thing with their rod? You know, it could be something really, really niche like that. But also, like you just said, how on earth is it that Steptoe and Son still live in the back of my head somewhere where I'm creating this monstrous dark horror movie?
That's got nothing to do with it, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or it might even be just a transition in terms of an edit from one scene to another. I've taken it from Diamonds Are Forever or something like that. It's because it's just an odd transition that just becomes something that that you can now do. But I've always liked those. I never saw a film as just film. It's also because film's also music and it's also
Yeah, of
words.
course, yeah.
Performance, and it's like what you're saying about it's not just words on a page, right? It's shapes, it's sounds, and I kind of love that idea. It's never just one thing, I don't think.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Rob, I don't really have any other questions unless you're working on something. What are you working on now? Let's
What
finish
am I
on that.
working on
What are you
now?
working on? You've probably got five things on the go.
Well, there's at least two. Yeah, I've got another novel that I'm working on called Webs. Well, it's going to be a really short novel. Novella is probably a better term for it, or very, very, very long short story. And that's a kind of Rosemary's Baby type, abusive demons kind of story fused with a you can never really go home, can you? Type of a tale. So I'm looking at that at the moment, and it'll probably be that Pogue Girl Publishing support me with that again, because they're lovely people to work with and do great horror writing across the UK and the US. And I'm also just starting to take my f next steps into some poetry. I want to do something about Saint Catherine of Siena. So I don't exactly know what it's going to be yet, because it's literally just in the word splat mode, of notes and things. But she was such an interesting woman who had such a strange and phenomenal life. I would like to do some kind of narrative, and it feels like it should be a narrative poem or a sequence of narrative poems about her. So that's what you can look forward to next from RM Francis.
That was my talk with RM Francis, and you can buy his new poetry collection, Palmer, from V Press. Thanks to RM Francis for talking with me, and thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.